Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this episode, Dr. Sarah Wise from Atlanta, Georgia. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Ed McCool from the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans, Louisiana. Dr. McCool is a senior author on the recent IFAR publication, Enhancing Nasal Endoscopy, Classification, Detection, and Segmentation of Anatomical Landmarks Using a Convolutional Neural Network. And we'll be discussing that paper today. So welcome, Ed, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on the paper.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be here.
So we'll get right into our discussion. Over the last decade, and particularly, I think, in the last few years, we've heard a lot about artificial intelligence. And this is not a new concept, but it's definitely being talked about more and more. We hear about it on news outlets and social media and discussions relating to our work, and increasingly in our subspecialty of rhinology. I was hoping that we could start off with just a quick rundown of some of the different terms that are frequently used in these conversations. Artificial intelligence is certainly one of those terms, but we also hear phrases like machine learning or deep learning, et cetera. So I was hoping maybe you could give us a quick rundown of what these different terms mean, so that those of us who lack familiarity with these concepts can understand the conversations a bit better. And admittedly, I might be talking about myself. I could perhaps benefit from some education here.
You can't go anywhere or last even an hour listening to the radio without hearing something about AI or its permutations these days. And this is really the culmination, I guess, of really decades of developments in computer science and frankly, in related disciplines like data science and statistics. But when we talk about AI, everyone's, kind of uses it as interchangeable thing to mean anything that's digital tech that generates some guidance or insight that is similar to what you might get if you asked another person. Ask the human. But within it, there's actually subsets of AI, as you mentioned. Machine learning has been around for a long time. It's basically statistical methods that are applied to create an outcome, to create a prediction based on a set of input data. That's a large subset of what we would consider AI now. Within that, have something called deep learning, which is where you can actually predict insights that wouldn't be strictly predicted from the raw statistical data. And then the most exciting thing recently is these neural networks. So there are different types of neural networks. That's what starts to resemble the very complicated, multi-layered, multi-dimensional decision processes that mimic what happens in a human brain. To segue that into the paper we're going to talk about, there's a thing called a convolutional neural network, which is the secret sauce behind image processing. And so I can talk a little bit more about that as well. But that's a little bit of the hierarchy of what we refer to when we mean AI.
Thank you so much. With that in mind, could you discuss a little bit more about your overall aim in performing the work that you did for this paper? What were the objectives of the study, and specifically in evaluating nasal endoscopy using these techniques?
Absolutely. One thing that, as a rhinologist, that has always been a little bit of a lingering concern for me is that the examination that we do is not completely standardized. There's an operator dependency to it. There is room for interpretation, you could say, of what we see. And so I always thought, what would be a way to standardize or create some guardrails for defining the things that we see when we do nasal endoscopy? And people like you or I, Sarah, I think, a dozen times a day when we're in the clinic, we're doing nasal endoscopy just to gain a diagnosis. I'm not even talking about surgical implications. So, as time went on and the capabilities for machine learning matured and we began to get into the modern era of the ascent of AI, I had the opportunity to work with some true experts in the field. And long story short, applied for a grant and created a team and hired a couple of computer scientists with expertise in computer vision and used some of the data that I had been collecting for the past decade or so in the form of images and videos. And this sort of the substrate and the combination of factors that allowed this paper to happen, which is essentially to train and then create a machine learning model that can perform rudimentary analysis of what is being seen when we look with an endoscope inside the nose. In the title, I say it can identify anatomic landmarks. So the specific landmarks that we wanted to identify are the turbinates, the inferior turbinate and the middle turbinate. And the reason those are important, just for a brief comparison, is I think is a parallel with, say, with GI endoscopy, like colonoscopy, which the colon and most of the GI tract is essentially a hollow tube. And so as it is with most areas we do endoscopy, the trachea and the esophagus. So if anything is sticking out of the side of that tube, it's probably abnormal. And so it's a little bit of an easier task for the GI endoscopist. But for the nasal endoscopist, if you have something sticking into the lumen that you're examining, it very well may be totally normal. In other words, it may be a turbinate. And so we felt that in anticipation that we as a field would want to develop eventual algorithms to help us interpret these examinations, we need to first lay the groundwork of what a normal examination should look like and what those normal contours are. And so that's what led to this paper, and we were very pleased with the findings.
Excellent. So can you tell us a little bit more about the actual methods? And you mentioned that you were going to talk a bit more about the convolutional neural networks and kind of what that means and how it's applied to this nasal endoscopy examination. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about the methods themselves.
Absolutely. So you know, there is some technical jargon here, and I'm gonna try to keep it fairly high level for a clinical audience. So there's this field called computer vision, and it's actually that is when you look at with your smartphone and you have your library of images, and it has a little option where you can search for the face of your sister, and it can find all the images of your sister. And you say, wow, how does it do that? It does that using computer vision algorithms, which are essentially these things called convolutional neural networks, where it creates layer after layer of different combinations of pixels within the screen, and they all kind of overlap with each other. And then as you connect the layers from one to the, you know, 1, 2, 3, 50, 100 layers, it eventually creates an output, which is then matched against a known figure or a known input, which would be your sister's face. Okay, so we kind of wanted to do the same thing with nasal endoscopy. The way you create an algorithm like this is you first train it. And we have many thousands, in my practice, I've collected many thousands and thousands of images and video frames. But to do something like this, you need about 1,000 of each class. Of that's sort of a rule of thumb. And so in our study, we did training on a set of about 1,000 images of middle turbinates and 1,000 of inferior turbinates. So how did we know which those were? Well, part of the real heavy lifting of a project like that is actually doing what we call labeling. That requires special software, and it requires team members or research team members who understand what nasal endoscopy actually looks like. So I won't bore you with the whole validation process, but we had a small team of clinically trained research associates who sat in front of a computer and drew with a little digital crayon on the screen, and they outlined or segmented a middle turbinate. And then when they saw an inferior turbinate, they did the same with an inferior turbinate. And they did that for a couple of thousand images. And that creates the input. And so then we followed standard methods where we would assign about 80% of those images for the training, and then about 5% for what's called the validation, where they tweak some parameters called hyperparameters, really, of how fast the thing would learn and so on. And then about 15% to test that our training was successful. And that's what we reported in the results as these metrics that essentially get at the accuracy. They talk about the recall and the precision and what's called the F1 score, which are all just different ways of saying how accurate the model was at correctly predicting that a middle turbinate was in fact a middle turbinate.
So I'm learning a lot already, and I greatly appreciate. And I also appreciate you putting this all of these technical aspects into terms that those of us who don't do this, day to day in the research setting can understand. So It seems like, as I'm listening to you and as I've read the paper, that the nasal endoscopy images that you used were primarily from sort of healthy, non-diseased patients. Was there perhaps an opportunity for the algorithm that you're developing, or will there be in the future, for this to kind of determine the difference between a turbinate and a polyp, or a mass in the nose, or an enlarged adenoid pad, et cetera?
You've seen the future, Sarah. And I think that's sort of front of my mind. And I know I'm not the only one who's been thinking this way in recent years. We started this work. I mean, I started collecting these images 10 years ago, but started this particular project about 2 years ago, a little more actually. This is how long these things take to come to fruition. We absolutely, even at this stage, we've continued to do some work, and we can identify and differentiate middle turbinates from polyps and from other structures, for instance. And I will point out, actually, this data set was not limited to healthy individuals. Let's just say I do nasal endoscopy on everyone. Some are going to be normal and some are not. We're not, you know, we tend to have a higher, you know, some pretest probability that we're going to find something abnormal if we're bothering to scope a patient. But a lot of times it's normal. But this data set also included patients with polyps and included patients with mucus or crust or septal deviations. Even including those, we had performance well in the 90% range. So it shows that the model has what we call robustness, that it's broadly applicable, not just to normal patients. The one thing I will point out, we did exclude patients who had sinus surgery because they might be missing turbinates, or you can see, you know, into their ethmoid, and that kind of would distort the learning algorithm. So at least for the purposes of this paper, these were unoperated patients, but that was really the only restriction. And so we think that as we continue to do our work, we're reassured that this model has robustness and could be potentially applied clinically to a general ENT practice.
Yeah. So I'd love to hear, you know, a little bit more about what you would describe as the major key findings of the study. Would you consider this kind of a report of the validation of this model and your techniques, or what in your words are the key sort of outcomes of the study that you did?
Yeah, thank you. The biggest takeaway is that this is proof of concept for us. We know that machines can learn. That sort of uncanny sensation that we get when we think about it is going to become normal if it hasn't already for a lot of us. But we found that properly constructed and trained convolutional neural network can, which is open source, by the way, freely available to anyone who knows how to use it. It can be trained to identify some of the key structures in nasal endoscopy and do it with a high level of accuracy. One of the other things we found, and this is not reported directly in the paper, but is that the process we used to conduct the study, I alluded to a small army of clinically trained research associates. Essentially, we took people who were essentially medical students and who are in their clinical years. They knew anatomy, they'd studied the atlases, but they didn't know much about ENT, right? Because, you know, the old adage that ENT in medical school stands for expect no training. So we took their sort of template of medical knowledge, and we sat down and trained them of what to look for in nasal endoscopy. And we had a process to validate, sort of get inter-rater reliability, remediate, retrain, and then compare them with a panel of experts, myself included, as well as three other experts who actually are acknowledged but weren't authors on this particular study. So I point this out because we had to sort of discover this for ourselves of how to, short of me, myself alone, sitting down and annotating 2,000 or more images, we had to come up with a feasible process. And that was one of the big findings for us that I would like to share with the audience or anyone who thinks they may want to potentially engage in research like this. There's a lot of parts to it, but it's not insurmountable. And having a process to create the labeled images using your close associates, i.e. students or trainees or those who are adjacent to you, can actually yield very good results with very good reliability.
I think those are very important points and, you know, good information for anyone who's as you said, considering taking on something like this. I did notice that one of the figures in your paper is titled Confusion Matrix, which might in fact be a description of my daily life. But anyway, it seems that this figure shows that in rare instances, the middle turbinate is confused for the inferior turbinate on the image analysis and vice versa. Sometimes the inferior turbinate is confused for the middle turbinate. Is there anything else that the turbinates might have been confused for in the study or any time when the image analysis couldn't really determine what a structure was?
That's a good question. Yeah, confusion matrix is just a statistician's term for that four square box where you have, you know, essentially true positives and false positives on each axis. But I love the analogy. This is a forced classification situation. So it was either identified as a turbinate of one type or the other or not. So as the category of what it was mistaken for, we don't have insight into what it was mistaken for. But anecdotally, because there was only 9 false positives or false negatives, I did look at them. And the things they were mistaken for were like the torus of the Eustachian tube. In one instance, only one instance up was it mistaken for a polyp. And then mucus of, you know, particular glob-like configuration would have been misinterpreted. So it wasn't one specific thing. It doesn't really make me very concerned about the eventual performance of a model like this. And one thing that is absolutely known about neural networks is the more data you feed into them, the smarter they get. So if we, you know, now we have well over 2,000 images that we work with in the experiments we're doing. And I would imagine if we reran this confusion matrix, it'd be a lot less now.
Yeah. And that's, you know, something that's certainly important about this type of work is that the accuracy tends to get better over time, as I understand it. Were there any findings in the study that you weren't expecting or anything that was surprising to the research team as you all went along or examined your data?
The thing that was surprising, I've already alluded to actually, was that even in cases where abnormal pathology was clearly present, it did not diminish the ability of this algorithm to correctly identify what it was looking for, to classify and detect and segment. I haven't defined those terms. So basically, classify means somewhere in this image, it's either column A or column B. Detect means it can say where it is in the image, but it doesn't tell you the shape. And segmentation means it shows you the actual shape of the thing. It draws like a little mask or an outline on it. And so we are surprised that all three of these performance metrics seem to be unaffected by the presence of things like big globs of crust. And actually figure 2, I believe, has several just representative images with their segmentation masks on them and the detection boxes. And you see, I think there's one with like a big glob of mucus. There's another with a terrible septal deviation that's just distorting the inferior turbinate. So you actually would have thought it was a middle turbinate a lot of this, if you were just naive to the process, you could easily mistake it, but it didn't fool our model. And there was one even with a person who had a big septal perforation, which I had not thought to exclude because the person had a non-surgical septal perforation. But I think that's in the figure somewhere, and it didn't distract from the performance of the model. And that was with only 2,000 images. I will point out, I say only 2,000 images. When we started this work, I'll just give you a little brief context. There were exactly 2 other papers using machine learning to interpret nasal endoscopy. One was out of Korea, and the other was out of Turkey, and they were both published within the past year of the time we started this. I mean, they were looking for inverted papillomas and polyps and trying to distinguish the two. Those data sets use just a few hundred images. I think, you know, so the low hundreds, and they were still able to rudimentarily do what they had hoped to do. So 2,000 is actually a pretty good set. And as I already mentioned, as time goes on, you know, we're adding to this, others will add their own data, I have no doubt. And we'll have some very robust models to help us with our clinical practice in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of sort of where this goes clinically, I think one of the biggest questions on most people's minds is, what is the future of AI in rhinology or machine learning in rhinology? Will we soon have an app for our smartphones and our patients' smartphones where they can attach a little camera and have their noses analyzed in seconds in their own home? You know, we're already seeing some smartphone apps for ear examinations and things like that. And so what's next? Are we soon to be out of a job as diagnostic rhinologists?
Oh boy, lots of juicy questions there. I'll take a pass on some of them because my crystal ball is in the shop today. But the future is certainly going to involve in AI. We're going to have this clinical decision aids that help us. I'm not even talking about computer vision, not even images, just clinical data. You know, especially if we're on an EHR, we have a patient's records at our fingertips. Could be easily integrated. We know how many antibiotics they've had, or what duration of allergy management they've had, what sprays they've used, time since prior surgery, if they've had such a thing. And it's really not a very complex process in the machine learning world to create a decision aid that incorporates data like that and then puts out a probability of success of certain treatments. 80% likely that surgery is the best option, 20% likely it's a biologic, 10% it's dietary modification, who knows? On the endoscopy side, I think we're not going to be out of a job. People are going to need our skills. I firmly believe there's much more need for our services than we can accommodate. And I think just in the way that we bemoan, as those of us who have general practices or remember our training in general ENT, of course you look in the ear. That's part of the examination. And bemoaning all the many egregious examples of people come to us with, an earache, and no one ever looked in their ear. They never looked in the ear in the ER. My primary care never looked in the ear. And how egregious that seemed. And they're coming to us just so we can look in the ear, possibly when we'd rather be doing something else. And I think the same kind of can apply for inside the nose. I think even fewer people get their noses looked in. Maybe your experience is different, but hardly anyone that I talk to says anyone's ever looked in their nose. If there were a way where people could have their noses looked in before they even arrive in our office, that would screen out a lot of, I would say, less high acuity visits for people like us. And it would also give sort of create a record of what's happening with people, what's happening inside these areas, what's happening in the sinuses, which doesn't exist currently. I could go on, but I think the future is very exciting. And no matter how many people have apps that are able to peek in these different places or tell us things about ourselves, there's still going to be a need, an appetite, a desire for the opinion of a medical professional and to have a thorough examination when it's called for.
Well, thank you for validating our jobs and giving me hope that I'll still be working in my career in the future. And I'd like to kind of close out by thanking you for joining me. I'd really like to encourage our listeners to get the manuscript and review it. It's great. It has some good thoughts about or brings to mind some thoughts and questions about, where this might bring us in the next 5-10 years. Do you have any last comments before we conclude, Ed?
No, yes. I want to thank you. Sarah, for your interest and for your graciousness as a host and for the opportunity to sort of share this exciting work and revel in the moment where AI is really capturing people's minds and showing a way and in which it could actually be used in our practices and hopefully get us all thinking about what's to come.
Yes, thank you, Ed. I've really enjoyed our talk. It's really been an excellent discussion. And again, congratulations to you and your colleagues on your publication. And thank you, of course, to our Scope It Out listeners. This is Sarah Wise for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. And I'm signing off for now. Until next time.